Today is Monday, August 10th, 2020. It's LA Podcast. I'm Hayes Davenport. I'm here with Scott Frazier. Alyssa Walker is on vacation. That way they always say it on like NPR. Alyssa Walker. Terry Gross is on vacation.
Yes.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm excited for our big episode. We are going to prop it like it's hot. Yeah. If you recall, last year, we had a segment called Prop It Like It's Hot, where we took every California and city and county ballot measure, and we talked about them in each episode, and it was a huge ordeal, and it took a huge amount of time. So we're just getting it all done in one episode.
Which was actually something people requested that we do.
It made consulting our words as a reference impossible.
Sure.
Because it was so spread out, you had to skip search across a million different episodes to find the thing that you wanted to hear us talk about. And so I'm sure people just didn't even bother. But now you can just listen to this episode for all of your needs related to California ballot propositions. But we have some other stuff.
Go ahead. Collaborate and listen.
I don't like that as much.
You don't like Vanilla Ice?
I just don't like I don't like anything about it. Let's talk about, though, we have some other really juicy stuff to get into at the top of this episode. I'm so ready to get going. It's pretty warm today in Los Angeles. To record this show, I have to shut off all air conditioning and fans and close all windows in my very small kind of office room, and I'm already drenched. So this episode will have that energy permeating through it of just me being disgusting.
Yeah.
What about you?
I'm very tired because I discovered that my landlord plugged in a carbon monoxide alarm into a wall where there was no outlet and just carved one with a knife. So I didn't sleep that well for reasons related to that.
Because I saw you posted it. It has gone viral. And I wonder if your landlord was kind of thinking, I think Scott could use a little clout.
Yeah.
I will leave this little clout present for him. And hopefully he doesn't die of carbon monoxide inhalation.
It was sort of like a time delay fuse on the clout. Like not clout chasing, but I'm like drafting after the clout that my landlord is leaving in her wake.
Speaking of clout, let's get in. Big story this week. Fox 5 haircut. Bill Malugan, intrepid local TV news field reporter. The Bob Woodward of the Tampa Chino.
Uh-huh.
First generation racist can we get Pokemon.
I was just asking if we could get like a Tampa Chino sting inserted in
here. Let's do the Tampa Chino sting. The song written for this show by Daniel Brown, who goes by Importer musically. So every time we mention Bill Malugan from now on, we play the Tampa Chino sting. So producer Brian Holmes, you just put it in right here. Fox 5's Bill Malugan. Great. He was the person that broke that story. And yeah, like I was saying, he's the Charmander to what's the middle one? Charmeleon to Jesse Waters' Charmeleon to Tucker Carlson's Charizard.
I
he accumulates to enough experience points in the form of retweets.
I referred to Bill Malugan, I think to you and Alyssa, as the person in the Fox newsroom who seems most desperate to be beamed up to the Fox mothership.
And I think it is going to work.
I don't see how it wouldn't work.
Yeah, but he is absolutely on the path. He's back with another big story, a Tampa Chino level story. Bill Malugan on August 7th. Posted that a public records request reveals that L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin, former L.A. podcast guest, so this affects us as well. So this is his actual tweet. L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin, who voted to defund LAPD by $150 million, has called LAPD to his home 8 times since April 4th, 2020, including to provide extra patrols and protection from peaceful protesters at his house. And he put the link to the records request, which also reveals Mike Bonin's address to any of the right-wing nuts who didn't currently have it. Not exactly the most responsible act for a journalist. And he says in a reply, Bill says, "I do not deserve any credit for this. Yeah. Someone else filed this records request. And once it is fulfilled, LAPD posts it publicly and it becomes publicly available info," implying that Bill Malukin, just on his daily trawl through LAPD, like, posted public records requests. Diligent reporter that he is, just happened to come upon this.
This is his beat. He's just he's pounding the pavement, digitally speaking.
And then he says, "The request does not say who filed it, but props to whoever did it."
Oh, sure.
It's a total mystery to him. Who filed this? Who sent it to him? It's all, he just stumbled upon this treasure and is sharing it with the world. So this is meant to impugn Mike Bonin as a hypocrite, someone who does not believe in police, who wants to defund the police and yet has used the police himself, has called them in cases of emergency. This also happens to coincide with an effort on the part of the LA Police Protective League, the police union, to brand Mike Bonin as a hypocrite. They are they're sending out mailers. They have some kind of TV or digital advertising built around the very catchy idea that Mike Bonin loves flip-flops.
Yep.
And they talk about how in 2017, he wanted to increase police patrols in his district near like Venice and near the beach. And now in 2020, he wants to defund the police. And they are, to the first 2,000 people who respond, they are advertising that they will send you flip-flops with Mike Bonin's face on them, which has turned me into a hype beast. These flip-flops are a must cop. I will wait at just like Nike and these other shoe companies that's premised on scarcity, there's only 2,000 pairs.
I must have one of these. That's a collector's item for sure.
Oh my God. And I don't know anyone who has gotten theirs yet, but I know a lot of people who have signed up.
When you're going out to the maskless protest and you're rocking a pair of Bonin flip-flops, please, it's over.
And they look so loud. It's like the really, really cheap kind that just like slap really hard on the ground. So you're like waking up the council member you're protesting outside the house up with no mask. Scott.
What's up?
You are someone, sort of a Ronin of filing CPRA requests. You have asked for information from the government that they are legally mandated to give you many times. What stands out about this particular records request that Bill Malukin has stumbled upon to you?
So what's particularly strange, let's say, about what Bill Malukin posted on Twitter is that the request has what I would call an unlikely amount of detail included in the actual request itself. First of all, it is a request for specific, like you said, it includes his address. It's a request for specific calls to Mike Bonin's address, which I don't understand. If you were just like the average, Bill Malukin credits this to an average citizen or whatever. If you were an average citizen, I'm not sure how exactly you would come up with the detail that you were looking for, calls made to Mike Bonin at 2359 on April 4th, or to the minute. or 12:39 a.m. on April 5th. This goes on for, you know, whatever he says it is, 8 calls, all to a specific location. Includes things that, again, unaffiliated persons probably wouldn't have access to. The type of code that was used to initiate the call, and gets a response really quickly. Gets a very detailed response very fast. LAPD has not been well known for responding with this kind of rapidity to public records requests. And they're not alone in that. That's actually kind of uniform across the law enforcement sphere. But this response comes quickly.
This one came back in 8 days.
Yeah.
6 business days.
I mean, it helps that it was so specific that you knew exactly sure what calls you were looking for. I can say personally, as somebody who's done, hundreds or whatever number of CPRA requests, normally you are not fishing, but you are saying, I know what type of information I'm looking for. For example, I might do something like, I want to know what the city council member's office has said about LASA, or I want emails that come from a specific person. I've never actually had the good fortune of being able to say, I want the email that Jose Huizar sent at 12:45 p.m. that included all of these words, etc. Implies that you actually have seen what you are looking for and are just looking for a way to make it public so that you can maybe hand it off to your friend, Bill.
So what are you saying? The only people who would know to the exact minute when Mike Bonin would have made these calls to get a police response for protests would be the police themselves. So are you saying that someone within the LAPD filed this request so it would be publicized, so they could then leak it to Bill Malugan to impugn a public official who is trying to go after their money?
I would never say, oh yeah, actually that is exactly what I'm saying. I'm sorry. I would go that far. Exactly. That I think is pretty clearly what has happened here. The LAPPL has made a practice of targeting elected officials who, I mean, we had it from Marquise Harris Dawson that they would target an official even if it was just a matter of them voting unsuccessfully against them. Now, of course, we have the majority of council getting together and voting on this quote unquote defund measure, which is really a haircut, really, in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
And they have responded.
One single individual hair.
One hair.
Literally, yes. A haircut.
And they have responded very aggressively and muscularly to that. And they have, you brought up before we started recording, they have done something similar to Nury Martinez. They have used this same line of attack of, you have in your life potentially called the police, although in Mike Bonin's case that is under dispute. And yeah, now
we'll talk about that.
And now you're saying you want to cut the funding for the police. So Bill Malugan is a beneficiary, not just for the LAPD, but also for the Sheriff's Department. I think across the spectrum of law enforcement locally, he is the beneficiary of the Police Protective League, the Sheriff's Deputy Union, and other actors who are, I mean, the sheriff himself, in all likelihood, who are wanting
to
push.
He has said many times that he does speak directly with the sheriff and get information from him at times.
It seems like any story that is appearing under his byline in Fox these days is coming directly from, he's the voice of the police department, basically.
Including when it comes to the Tampa Chino, we don't know if that could have come from the sheriff's department or the police department, because
sure,
it was an LAPD officer that it happened to, but it was the sheriff's department investigating. And I want to point out, when the Nury Martinez information went out, it also happened to coincide with a mailer that the LAPPL was sending out about Nury Martinez at the exact same time. Almost like this is a coordinated effort between the LAPD and the LAPPL, their like political advocacy arm, basically, to take private police information or information that only the police have,
right,
and release it for political and financial gain to stop elected officials from going after their money. We do want to point out that these accusations by Bill Mulugan appear to be false, completely false. He accuses Mike Bonin of having called in the police to respond to protests. Mike Bonin says that he has evidence that he specifically asked for police not to come
right
when these protests were happening. He didn't want police presence. He didn't want the situation to be like escalated or for them to freak out or anything. The only time he says that he did call was when a protester left a bunch of syringes on his doorstep. And afterwards, he called the police to say, not an emergency call, just said, come by and pick these up as like evidence.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, like I said, the codes are included in the request themselves and mention that they are, quote unquote, officer initiated calls.
They say code 6 in the request, which once again, this requester really has an amazing handle on police terminology.
So then what we have from Bill Mulugan is a screenshot from the Notes app saying from his source that these were definitely not officer initiated requests. But what we also have from the request itself is a look at the specific code called a code 6 that is identified in the body of the request as being an officer initiated call. So it seems to align with what Mike Bonin is saying and not with what the anonymous source providing detail to Bill Mulugan is saying, although Mulugan is sort of uncritically, I mean, this is kind of the thing that he is now making a name for himself as doing, is uncritically allowing anonymous police sources to say whatever they want, even if it doesn't seem to make sense with what is publicly available information.
By all appearances, to provide completely false information, to lie about an elected official.
For political purposes.
For political and personal financial gain.
Yeah.
So like every goofy, funny story that we talk about on the show, it's actually very sinister and scary. Yeah. And we probably should not be laughing about it. These are people that have a monopoly on state violence and access to a huge amount of sensitive private information for residents. And they are demonstrating a willingness, an eagerness to weaponize that information to go after public citizens. It is incredibly scary, and I don't think this story is receiving the level of attention and engagement that it should beyond Bill Mulugan's original tweet getting 4,000 retweets or whatever.
Yeah,
is another sad result of this.
Mm-hmm.
His post goes all over the place, and Mike Bonin's denial of it doesn't do big numbers. So many more people will think that this story is true than ever hear that it wasn't true.
Sure. I mean, I think that is absolutely the case. But also, the Cernoviches, whatever, Paul Thomas Watson, the people who are retweeting Mulugan don't care whether or not it's true. All it needs is to be out there, and that's enough for them and their base to kind of sink their teeth into. Also, the entire listenership of John and Ken's station.
Right.
Those people hate and have hated Mike Bonin for a long time. They don't particularly care whether or not this is true. What I think is a really troubling trend for Bill Mulugan as he's becoming a more famous personage in the LA media scape is that he always seems to just be these are things that this is what Mike Bonin is saying. This is an anonymous response to what Mike Bonin is saying. He's never actually, as a journalist, doing what is his responsibility to assess the quality of his anonymous tips. He's not actually doing that in a public way, which I think is something that somebody should hold him accountable to do, but that does not seem to have happened up till now.
But he acts like he's just calling balls and strikes. The difference between him and like a Cernovich and like any like InfoWars person is people can consult his bio and it says that he's a reporter for not Fox News, for Fox 5. He's like a local news reporter. So he could see, he has the pretense of being unbiased, but he's flipping a coin and it's coming up heads every single time.
Yeah, right. Right.
It's only information that benefits the police and appears to be coming from police sources.
Yep.
And he should be fired.
Yeah.
He is absolutely going against the even most basic journalistic standards to provide false information. We now know multiple times information that has proven to be false. Let's quickly, because we have to prop it like it's hot. Scott, do you want to talk about what like new developments in sending young people back to school during a pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, just really quickly. So we are, as of the time that this recording comes out, we are, I think, a little over a week away from the start of the new school year. Obviously, this is a very trying time for a lot of parents, to say nothing of the teachers and administrators who are trying to pull off a school year, at least at the beginning of the year, in a remote fashion, despite what had likely been unrealistic hopes early on in the pandemic that maybe kids would be going back to school from the start of this school year. What we've seen in the past week is a little bit of movement. Now there is a framework for actually starting the school year, which, as basic as that is, that was in doubt. UTLA was rejecting proposals from LAUSD and its superintendent, Austin Buettner, as to how they were going to structure the school day. Now they have a basic framework in place. It is going to be remote. Teachers are going to be working. The school day is going to be about 6 hours long. It's going to be shorter than a normal in-person school day. Obviously, I think something that is being discussed a lot, particularly among Angelenos who have children and hopefully among the political classes, but maybe not that much beyond those two groups, is that we know that school functions not just as a place where education happens, but also is one of the few places in our society where a lot of social services come together. When you have a school district like LAUSD, which serves a predominantly minority community, and not just a minority community, but one that suffers from a variety of economic hardships, has high poverty levels, and is just extremely large, that when you talk about removing the physical schooling apparatus from those children's lives, you're getting rid of, for a lot of them, a hub for social services. And it's a very serious issue. One that we talked about recently when Marquise Harris Dawson, the council member, was on our show, but one that there's not a clear replacement for in our society. And I think, similar to the discussions that we're having about policing, we should be actually looking at, why is it that all of this funding comes in, all these services come in through schools, and they're not, you know, they're not replaceable by other means. In any case, what we have here is students will be learning online. Students will be doing a mix of, like, so teachers will basically have discretion as to whether or not certain lessons are done in live in person, or whether or not they're pre-recorded. That is, of course, necessary just for teachers to be able to get lessons in front of children and be able to then give attention individually where it is needed. Students are also expected to be able to have extended access to counseling services, just dealing with the trauma of being a child who is going through this. It's a considerable effort it's good that UTLA and LAUSD have at least agreed on how to move forward with this. But in terms of the immediate future for schooling in LA, I'm not sure how comfortable either UTLA or the parents are going to be with this holding for a long period of time.
It's this domino effect, right? Where the city and county open up business, parents have to go back to work. Yep. Their unemployment benefits are drying up at the federal level anyway, and the state yep. and city and county are not showing up to stop that from happening. Evictions are about to start happening again by all yeah. appearances in mid-August. So parents have no other option but to go back to work or become homeless. And that means that their kids don't have a childcare option, so they have to go back to school. I also want to point out that because of the rise of charter schools in LA, LAUSD has basically become where all special education services are consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means the parents whose kids maybe are less the least equipped to do Zoom education are basically all in LAUSD. I've heard from parents who say, my kid cannot sit in front of a computer for 5 hours a day. It's just not going to happen.
And also, I mean, Kyle Stokes had a great article for KPCC either this past week or the week before that went into the P3, the PPP loans that went out for small businesses. And
yeah.
the fact that charter schools have effectively been double dipping on recovery funds. So they've That's been right. able to get these loans that have not really been handled in a transparent fashion. I think 49 of the individual charter operators that are in LA County secured some amount of loans. So the total range is from somewhere between $75 million to $150 million. Not clear how much it is. But yeah, Kyle Stokes with KPCC had this article basically saying they've been eligible for this additional funding despite their or because of their line straddling status between public school and independent operator that public schools have not been eligible for. So just an additional layer, like you're talking about, of hardship for LAUSD to try and figure out how it's going to, what it's going to look like to be an LAUSD student in the near future.
So a very funny, very scary picture of Superintendent Austin Buettner in a classroom wearing a disinfectant backpack. Look like one of those old like super soaker enhancements yeah. where you like get the backpack with extra water. And this looks like a very bad Ghostbuster audition. And he's basically demonstrated that he is willing to personally suit up to blast spray these classrooms to allow them to reopen. But what's crazy about that is there is, I don't think, a ton of evidence that that kind of disinfectant really matters that much. I yeah. mean, like, you know, you spray down the surface contact is not a big deal. I guess you spray some, whatever, the particles out of the air, but then you're still filling a classroom with kids and yeah. teachers. You're not simultaneously disinfecting it while they're
no.
in the room. So it's almost like they're going through the motions on the appearance of a safe environment, but you know, it's inarguable that this is an incredibly dangerous situation.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, the intention seems to be to give parents the feeling that the school is doing everything that it can, which may or may not be true, but the intention is to say, we're doing everything that we can, and therefore it is safe to bring children back into the classroom environment,
yep.
which I think is much more in doubt at this point. And the further question of whether or not it's safe to have support staff and teachers in the classroom is an even graver doubt.
Shall we prop it?
Yeah, let's do it.
We've got 12 of these things on the state ballot. There's also a county ballot initiative that has not been completely finalized yet, right? Reimagine LA County?
That's right.
So we're going to talk about that separately. This is just the state ballot. It goes from 14 to 25. I have the even. Scott has the odds. in order to move things along, because we can get kind of caught up in these things for a while, I'm putting a timer on these. We decided 4 minutes per prop. Okay. I'm going to start with 14, and my time starts now. Okay. Prop 14 is a bond measure. It's $5.5 billion in bonds for state stem cell research through the State Stem Cell Research Institute. There is some history on this. Back in 2004, a very rich guy up in San Mateo named Robert Klein II championed and largely financed a ballot measure called Prop 71, which was a $3 billion bond to create a stem cell research center called the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. This is when stem cells, you remember in like the Bush era, stem cells were something that like people talked about and like got mad about.
Got very angry about. Yes.
Yeah. And then basically everyone moved on. But the Prop 71 was part of that. It's what part, like part of what engaged the debate, like Focus on the Family and these other groups were against Prop 71. They wanted to turn it into a political issue, but it passed. And so this institute got a $3 billion bond to research stem cells. But then guess what happened?
It ran out of money.
They ran out of money. That's correct. So now they're back and they are asking for $5.5 billion, which is this is a big bond measure. Just to compare it to some recent ones, the bond last year for supportive housing for people who are homeless, suffering from mental illness, was $2 billion, less than half of what this one is proposing. Other recent ones I feel like have ranged from like $1 to $3 billion. So this is a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's supported by the UC Board of Regents, and the campaign is financed primarily by Robert Klein II again. He has put $4 million into this, and nobody this time, you know, the conservative groups have moved on from this and they are not getting involved in this anymore. So I am, you know, I spend a lot of time Googling what's the deal with stem cell research right now, because it was held up for a long time as this like potentially really transformative way of like coming up with new medical treatments and things like that. At the same time, I have heard of stem cell therapy being kind of like junk science, that, you know, when they like inject stem cells into different parts of your body to like regenerate tissue and stuff like that. Like I think that like publicly available stem cell treatments right now are not necessarily useful, but what they're doing, I mean, this is like research that medical experts and scientists do seem to think is still potentially fruitful for like really transformative treatments when it comes to like muscular dystrophy or cancer or Alzheimer's specifically. And, you know, like I'm generally in favor of just kind of like open field research, you know, just like trying stuff until it works. So I am a tentative yes on this, but I would like to hear more. This is actually, of all these ballot measures, this is the one that to me is like the most confusing. It is so much money. And like, you know, it's a bond, like we'll pay it back, you know, it's like whatever, it's not a big deal. But at some point, I think there is like fatigue around these money raising ballot measures, and you got to pick your spots.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so with bonds, right, you're like typically saying that whatever the benefits are that are going to come from it are spread over a long enough period of time that repaying it back makes sense. I'm curious, though. You know, there is still like the like you're saying, there's the fatigue, there's the opportunity cost of what do you actually put that bond on? So we can come back to that.
Okay, Scott, Prop 15, timer starts now.
Okay, Prop 15, I didn't realize when I did the odd even split that I was giving myself a lot of the best ones in here.
I like mine too, actually.
Okay.
There are a lot of good ones this year.
We can fight about it. The basis for Prop 15 goes all the way back to 1978 when a group of diehard Reagan super fans coming out of Los Angeles in the Beverly Wilshire Association and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association decided that they just did not want to pay property taxes. They owned a lot of property, didn't think they should have to pay property taxes. In fact, didn't think that their property taxes should ever go up again. They passed Prop 13, ushering in the never-ending nightmare that has been public finance since the late 70s. So in today's world, we have the growing, I think, understanding that having a bunch of rich people who own land rapidly appreciating value continue to pay decades-old valuations on their property taxes is not a reasonable way to run any size of economy. Prop 15, what it would do is it would say, if you have a commercial building, because those are included in the benefits that accrue to property owners under Prop 13, if you have a commercial building, then that gets taxed as a normal property would. The value increases, you pay more in property taxes. There are some carve-outs there for basically for like smaller commercial units and things like that to make this more palatable. But the goal is to achieve what's known as a split roll, where you have residential property, homes, smaller apartment buildings being taxed one way, and then larger apartment buildings, commercial and manufacturing, industrial, things like that being taxed a different way. This is huge. It results in $15 billion a year or something like that is the estimate for what would go towards local governments, which have largely been deprived of tax streams by Prop 13, and to schools, for which the same thing is true. So it's billions of dollars a year taken out of the pocket of corporations largely and extremely wealthy people who have been strangling public services in this state for 40 plus years at this point. It's an obvious yes. It's do it. Vote yes.
Prop 13 gutted school budgets by up to a third overnight when it passed in 1979. You indicated on Twitter earlier today that lots of opponents of this ballot measure, Prop 15, say it's just the beginning of a campaign to undo Prop 13. And now they're going out. First, they came for the corporations, but next they'll come after residents and yep. small businesses and make everyone pay their fair share of property taxes, to which your answer was
yes, absolutely.
That's correct.
That is correct. First, I mean, honestly, this is Prop 13. I've said this before. It is not a sustainable tax break. You're giving a tax break to people who have things very well. And so the natural result of that is, in order to make it sustainable, Prop 13 had to be expanded and expanded. Once you start cutting into the base for it, I think it will fall apart. And I want that to happen.
And just as an example of what's happening in like the potential disasters associated with Prop 13, you are living through them right now. If you live in California, we've had to pin all of our economic hopes on income tax, which are much more volatile to economic shock. And so that's why California, which was expecting a $6 billion surplus, is now facing a $54 billion deficit, while property values have remained basically intact. Sorry, I went over your time. I'll dock myself a few minutes. Proposition 16, let me set my alarm for 4 minutes. Here we go. Proposition 16, this one also is an effort to undo damage from another proposition that conservative Angelinos basically put forward decades ago. So back in 1996, there was a measure on the ballot called Prop 209, which was the California Civil Rights Initiative, which if you read it very fast, sounds great.
Yep.
It says, the state cannot discriminate against or grant preferential treatment on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, and public contracting. That's great. I hate discrimination. So I, of course, am very much in favor of Prop 209. But of course, this was a ballot measure put forward by exclusively white Republicans.
Yeah.
A guy named Joe Gelman, who was the president of the Board of Civil Service Commissioners in the city of LA, guy named Arnold Steinberg, who's a Republican pollster, and Larry Arn, who's the president of the Claremont Institute, which has produced a lot of alt-right maniacs, later endorsed by Republican Governor Pete Wilson.
Yeah.
This was an effort beginning with court rulings in the 70s to ban affirmative action, in particular in the UC system, the state-run public university system. It was racist. Everyone knew it was racist at the time and was a deceptive effort to codify a ban on affirmative action at the state level. There was an LA City Council member that asked Mayor Reardon at the time to remove this guy, Joe Gelman, from the Board of Civil Commissioners because he was attempting to put this racist ballot measure on the state ballot. It passed.
Yeah.
And now this was actually Prop 16 repeals it. And that was it was actually put on the ballot by state legislators, all from Southern California, Miguel Santiago and Mike Gibson from L.A. and Shirley Weber from San Diego.
I love this a one full of those confusing repeal. Ones.
Sorry?
I love a full repeal.
Yeah, it's great. It's so clean, except it's very confusing because you're like, Prop 209 is bad, which means Prop 16, vote yes to vote no on Prop 209. But all you have to remember is yes on 16. Okay, I'm done with that one with a minute 20 to spare, which I'll need later.
All right, Prop 17. Now what we have is another great one put onto the ballot by the legislature. We are changing the Constitution. Well, that's the question. We are given the option to change the California Constitution, which sets the standards for who is eligible to vote in an election. This is not the only one of these that is on this year's ballot. But what Prop 17 proposes to do is to remove a condition where if you are currently on parole for a felony that you committed in the past or you were convicted of in the past, that you are not eligible to vote until you are no longer on parole. So the standards, basically, to run through them real quick, in California, you have to be a United States citizen to vote. You have to be 18 years of age. You have to be not declared mentally incompetent, and you have to not either be arrested or currently serving a sentence for a felony or currently on parole. So this proposes to cut cleanly the last one off of that. If you are on parole, it will give you back your access to the franchise, your right to vote.
Which, do you know how many other states allow parolees to vote? I don't know.
So there's actually a really good discussion of this in the legislature's analysis of this proposition. And so currently there is a wide disparity, a wide range of what individual states allow people to do. We have two states in the United States, Maine and Vermont, where even if you are convicted of a felony while you are serving your term, while you're incarcerated, you can still vote. Then there are 16 states and Washington, D.C., where you get automatic restoration of voting rights, even if you're on parole. California would be seeking to become the 17th state doing that. There are 21 states where you lose voting rights following incarceration for a set period of time, and 11 states where felons can lose their voting rights indefinitely.
But a lot of states have already done this thing that we're now putting on the ballot.
Yeah, we would be like just outside of the top third of the most progressive states.
Great. Done with a minute to spare. We're blowing through these. Prop 18 is perfectly named. This is another suffrage bill. Prop 18 says that you can vote if you turn, you can vote in a primary even if you're 17 years old, as long as you turn 18 by the general election. They already do this in 18 states. They've done it in Nebraska for 20 years. We are 20 years behind Nebraska on this voting rights issue. This is the beginning of what I hope will be an effort to make the voting age I mean, the voting age should be 13. What do you think it should be?
I would be cool with 14 or 13. I don't care. 14, 13. Doesn't matter. People are being affected by the decisions that they're not allowed to vote on.
Sure.
I'm typically in favor of making the franchise as broad as possible. It's not really the slippery slope people think it is.
And that we don't have, you weren't forced to stop voting later in your age.
Right.
Let's hear from an opponent of this ballot measure. The Election Integrity Project California, Inc. submitted an opposing argument that says 17-year-olds are legal minors. Under that definition, they are still considered children. They're almost all still living at home and under the strong influence of their parents. This is not conducive to independent thought and voting without undue pressure from their immediate superiors. 17-year-olds will almost always still be in high school and under the strong influence of their teachers. This, again, makes it less likely that they would be expressing their own independently thought out choices were they to be allowed to vote. So the problem is that students will potentially be influenced in some way by their teachers, which we do not want.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly not what they're paid for, to have any influence over students at all.
I just want to say, yeah. I just want to say, I know I've said it before, but this is the same argument that is used every time an expansion of the franchise is considered. And this one that we're talking about right now, Prop 18, is very minor expansion of the franchise. It is a fringe case, basically.
Yeah.
But every time there's a proposed expansion of the franchise, it is women will just vote the way that their husbands tell them to.
Yep.
Emancipated slaves will just vote the way that their employers will tell them to. It is always the same argument.
I mean, you could just easily say, like, white men will vote the way the majority of their friends vote. The Election Integrity Project is, of course, led by a Tea Party nutcase. In this case, Linda Payne, who collaborates with Tom Fitton, the Judicial Watch guy, who is always posting photos of himself just like busting out of tiny polo shirts.
Great.
And they have collaborated on many efforts to reveal the shocking fact that when someone dies, a government official doesn't immediately go to the voter rolls and remove them. Vote yes on Prop 18. Let's go to Prop 19. Scott.
Oh, man. Prop 19. This one also coming out of the legislature, which explains its weirdly terrible Frankenstein format. It is to be known as the Home Protection for Seniors, Severely Disabled Families, and Victims of Wildfire or Natural Disasters Act.
Wow. Who can relate?
This is the product of a lot of different things happening over the course of the past several years. Of course, we have had, so in 2018, we had a ballot measure put before the voters that would have allowed seniors to migrate their Prop 13 tax breaks, the same ones that we were just talking about, and move to a different county within the state. There are a lot of ways for individuals to keep these generous tax breaks, by the way. This one is favored in particular by the California Association of Realtors, who have long held the belief, probably founded, that seniors become trapped in their homes because they have it so good with Prop 13 that the prospect of moving somewhere else in California financially makes no sense. Their tax payments would balloon. So they just stay put. So the realtors want more home sales. That's one thing. Another thing that happened in recent years is an entire city burned to the ground. Paradise, of course, was subject to the horrific fires of a couple of years ago that cost nearly 100 people their lives and, you know, untold billions of dollars in damage. So this has sort of gained a weird coding of, we need to fund wildfire fighting services in some way. That's the second thread. And then the third one actually comes from friend of the show, Liam Dillon, who wrote a very famous story about Jeff Bridges getting tax breaks on his home through another, yet another Prop 13 affiliate measure that allows for the seamless transfer of tax breaks from parent to child, or in certain mm-hmm. circumstances, grandparent to grandchild, on the event of the elder party's death. So all of those things have very little to do with one another. There was originally a proposal to just take out the inheritance of the tax break. It is pretty egregious. It is like a total landed gentry type thing where you can just hand down throughout the generations one principal residence. This measure would not actually change that. Well, it would alter it. It would not remove it. But the main thing that is happening as a result of this measure is, first of all, we are saying, if we vote yes on this, that we would allow for seniors, people older than 55, to take that tax break with them somewhere else in the state when they move. Again, that's the...
Which
we already voted no on. The realtors are fully, brazenly in the wide open trying to sneak it through as part of a much mm-hmm. more popular measure in order to generate more home sales, because this went through the legislature, which is maybe bought is a too strong of a word, but it is in some sense strongly beholden to the realtor lobby. They've gone along with it. The second and much more popular thing that I was just referring to is that it would eliminate for any secondary property or anything other than a principal residence, commercial property, whatever, you would not be able to inherit tax breaks when your parents or grandparents die. It's a good measure. Things that the money would go in some way, shape, or form to fighting wildfires, which, as we know, is going to become a more integral part of our future. It's just going to be part of the future of California.
So you are accepting something that you were against a couple years ago.
Yeah.
In order to allow this paying for wildfire damage and the closing of this inheritance loophole, partial closing.
That is what I'm accepting it for. Like I said earlier, I view inherently, I know we're over time, I view inherently anything that you remove from the mountain of Prop 13 tax breaks as a good thing. Now, in this case, we are expanding that. It's paradoxically for a certain set of homeowners, but I think that the benefits that you get from eliminating the generational wealth transfer, it more than balances that out. And the last thing that I'll say is that it also does limit the actual tax breaks that you could get either from being older than 55 and moving, or from inheriting even a primary residence. So I think on the net, although this is a shady move by the realtors, and honestly, it's pretty cowardly that the legislature allowed it to go through in this form, I think it's still a win. I will vote yes for it.
And at least it puts a time limit on these benefits, where like the seniors get them, but then won't as easily be able to pass them along to
exactly
their children and grandchildren until the realtors figure out a way to get on the ballot that people are legally their own grandparents. Prop 20. See, this is a big one. Mine are good. Let me set my clock 4 minutes. Here we go. Okay, Prop 20. This one is about policing and criminal justice and mostly sentencing. And once again, this connects back to ballot measures of the past, primarily Prop 47 from 2014 and Prop 57 from 2016. In the early 2010s, California experienced the natural outcome of decades of hyper-criminalization and three strikes sentencing designed to lock up Black and brown people for as much of their lives as possible, which was
the Supreme Court told them that they had to immediately let people out of jail.
The jails got too full. It was a full house situation at every jail. And so the Supreme Court, yes, in 2011, ordered the state to reduce prison populations to no more than 137.5% of capacity. A case was called Brown versus Plata. Brown is Jerry Brown. A lot of jails are still in violation of this. Imagine being told that your jail could only have 137% of capacity and being like, what?
And being like, no, no, we're going to court no. to fight.
So they started frantically looking for ways to reduce the prison population. There was at least one law that was passed in the legislature, but a couple were passed on the ballot. One was Prop 47 in 2014, which if you want to hear John and Ken or anyone who listens to conservative LA talk radio, you want to see them get very red and mad, mention Prop 47. Prop 47 turned some felonies into misdemeanors. Shoplifting and like theft up to $950. $950 became the value. If what you stole or forged or whatever is under that, it's a misdemeanor. If it's over that, it's a felony. It used to just be a felony if you shoplifted or forged anything, as well as the personal use of most illegal drugs. So if you were using or in possession of drugs, used to be a felony, now it is a misdemeanor. And this is actually part of what gave George Gascon, the current candidate for LA District Attorney, some of his reputation as a progressive. He pushed aggressively for Prop 47 passing when he was DA of San Francisco, which is not something that most DAs do. It's certainly not something Jackie Lacey did. Prop 47 passed by 20 points, which is a lot in California. California does not tend to, you know, California is a tough on crime state traditionally. So that was a big deal. As many as 1 million Californians were eligible to change felony convictions on their records after Prop 47. And then 2 years later, Prop 57 changed the rules around parole. It allowed people who were convicted of nonviolent felony crimes, who served their full sentences and passed various screenings, to be eligible for parole, who were not previously. And it also allowed judges, instead of prosecutors, to decide whether to try certain juveniles as adults.
You know, what's crazy is California is a very tough on crime state. And I feel like at least part of the reason why Prop 47 did as well as it did was that Californians don't like having the national perception of the U.S. Supreme Court having to come in and say, you are treating your prisoners so horribly, you need to immediately let them go. Like, we're supposed to be liberal, et cetera, and not do things like that.
Yes, which the frequency with which a federal court has to come in at both a state and local level in California and say, hey, this is cruel and unusual punishment, stop doing this, would seem to belie that, but it happens all the time. So I'm going over time, sorry. Conservatives and a lot of these tough on crime Democrats have been experiencing a full-on shit fit ever since, mostly Prop 47, but Prop 47 is blamed for every fucking thing that happened, everything that's bad going on in LA right now. Homelessness, these people say with total sincerity, like, Prop 47 released all these criminals onto the streets, and if we didn't have Prop 47, we'd just be able to arrest them and put them back in prison for being addicted to meth. Yep. Like, that is the desired solution for a lot of people, including high up legislators, including Democrats. So now enter Prop 20 that's on the ballot now to try and rectify the situation by putting more people back in jail for longer.
Yep.
This is being put forward by Assemblymember Jim Cooper, who's a Democrat from up in Elk Grove outside Sacramento. Did you know how old the city of Elk Grove is, by the way?
It's new.
It's very new. It was incorporated in the year 2000.
And it's one of the fastest growing places in the state.
Which, from zero to
sure
anything, I imagine, is probably responsible for that. He is a former sheriff's captain from Elk Grove, one of these wonderful tough-on-crime Democrats we have in California, like our pro-energy Democrats, which is to say they are progressive on many things except the one issue they spend most of their time on, for which they are Republicans. Prop 20 would reclassify certain types of theft and fraud crimes, firearm theft, vehicle theft, unlawful use of a credit card, as misdemeanors or felonies, what are called wobblers, apparently. This was not a term I had heard before. But if you can pick, if a judge can pick between classifying it as a misdemeanor or felony, that's a wobbler. And it would also establish two additional types of crimes in the state code, serial crime and organized retail crime. We'll talk about organized retail crime in a second, and charge them as wobblers as well. It would also, I didn't even know about this. This is wild. It would require people convicted of misdemeanors that were previously classified as wobblers or felonies, like shoplifting, grand theft, or drug possession, to submit to the collection of DNA samples for state and federal databases.
Jesus.
So this might seem like right wing ideology, like, you know, race, like just like wanting to criminalize more people. It's partly ideological, but it's mostly a money play, like everything else on the ballot or in our criminal justice system. Who is paying for this to happen? It's the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, the prison guard, basically, as well as they put up $2 million and the Association for LA Deputy Sheriffs have put up $200,000. The LA Police Protective League has put up $200,000 and Albertson's Safeway has put up $100,000. But fundamentally, the correctional officers are putting up $2 million for this because fewer people in jail is a threat to their business model. Fewer inmates means fewer officers. Same for the sheriffs and the LAPPL. Decriminalization means less crime, which means fewer arrests, which means they get to spend less time just like hanging out at the station and in court racking up overtime.
You know what's crazy?
It doubles their income.
What's crazy is that they have spent so many years being like Prop 47. Cops have been saying Prop 47 makes it pointless for me, the beat cop, to even show up and do my job. But then you talk reducing their funding and they're like, wait, no, I didn't mean it.
This means less business. They operate like any other industry. And Albertsons, apparently, they're saying that since Prop 47 passed, there's been more organized retail crime where people deliberately steal exactly $949 of product because they know that they won't get a felony for it, which I'm skeptical is real. And they aren't putting that. They're only putting up $100,000. This is also one area where Mark Zuckerberg and the Chan Zuckerberg initiative have showed up for the better. Bad person, bad for America, bad for the world. Yes. But they put $1 million into Prop 47 the first time and are now putting up $250,000 against Prop 20. And Patty Quillen, who is the spouse of Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, is putting up $750,000. Vote no on Prop 20.
All right, Prop 21, you might remember from our last one of these, we talked about Proposition 10, which was a proposal to repeal a state-enacted statute known as Costa-Hawkins. Costa-Hawkins, this is a limitation on rent control that was passed by the legislature in the 90s, basically freezing in place any cities that had existing rent control at that time, mandating that vacancy, what's known as vacancy control, where rent control continues to be in effect even when there's a voluntary vacancy between tenants, that would be banned in the state of California. It remains so today. Then it also made it so that rent control would not be able to be applied to either condos or single family homes. Again, those all remain the case today. So Prop 10, which was a couple of years ago, lost by, I want to say, like 16 points, was a straight repeal of Costa-Hawkins. Many people, including this podcast, supported that effort. There were, I think, a couple of counties, the most populous counties, the most expensive counties, where it did pass. However, in general, it was, I think, too abstract and too remote to really gain much support elsewhere. So Prop 21 picks up where that left off, written by essentially the same group of people, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation and their subsidiary group, Housing is a Human Right, were instrumental in getting this on the ballot. This makes a few changes to what Prop 10 proposed to do. As opposed to Prop 10, which would have just eliminated Costa-Hawkins from the law book, now we are talking about modifying Costa-Hawkins instead, but in a way that is pretty substantial and I think gives probably gives activists more to say positively about what they're attempting mm-hmm. to accomplish. So what Prop 21 does, it eliminates the statewide requirement that rent control cannot be applied to any housing more recent than 1995, more recently occupied than 1995. It changes the requirement so that now you would be able to have what's known as rolling rent control, where any housing unit, once it is at least 15 years old from the point in time of either construction or when it became a residential unit, would be eligible to be covered by a local rent control policy.
So that's the difference between this new law and Costa-Hawkins, where they also froze rent control to buildings constructed prior to a certain year, in this case, 1979, but it didn't roll. And so it froze in 1979.
Costa-Hawkins froze at 1995. It froze every rent control policy that existed.
The policy that was there in 1995.
Could not be expanded right. to cover more buildings right. than it did at the point in time that it was passed.
Which in LA covered up until 1979. Yeah.
So removes that from Costa-Hawkins, allows for vacancy decontrol to, or sorry, vacancy control to be implemented or in places where it already exists, such as Santa Monica or West Hollywood, presumably would allow it to resume effect at such point in time as this measure might pass. It's a very good measure. I just like Prop 10, support it very strongly and hope that it finds more support this time around. Really, though, the state legislature should have done this themselves. Quite some time ago, they have.
Which they kind of said they would do and have made like little hand wave efforts yep. at. And, you know, they stopped like rent gouging at the state level. But they should have done this exact thing. We were critical after Prop 10 failed, or I was anyway, of the approach of doing it at the state level. While a lot of local municipalities were trying to pass rent control and were not really getting help from the same organizations that were putting Prop 10 on the ballot, and just like, don't let Republicans vote on this. Just let LA County, San Francisco, like the places that really need this. This is where our advocacy should be happening. But they've really improved their advocacy in two ways. One is this ballot measure just being more specific, I think has a better chance of passing at the state level. And also they're helping cities like Burbank specifically right now, is really trying to get rent control on the ballot. It looks like they're going to, and housing as a human right is helping them. So all around, yes, vote yes on Prop 21. Prop 22, this one goes back to another previous law, this time AB 5, which was signed into law only last September. AB 5 was a law put forward by Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez in San Diego, who has probably been forced to hire body doubles ever since AB 5 was passed, because it generated a massive freak out on a number of fronts. AB 5, we've talked about on the show before, it's pretty simple. It's a kind of a transformation of the gig economy to reclassify gig workers as employees of the company that they do the most work for. It affected yeah. a lot of different industries. There was a lot of hubbub over what it would do for freelancers, like journalists were capped at 35 submissions, after which they would become employees of whatever outlet they were submitting to. That is in the process of being undone, the submission cap for journalists. This whole thing was meant to codify a court order in a case called, it's often referred to as Dynamex, which was a same-day delivery company where a court said, hey, these workers that work for you are your employees. They work for you all the time. It's their primary job, and you need to give them benefits and do all the other things that companies have to do for employees.
Right.
But the companies that AB 5 really hit and were designed to hit were rideshare companies, app-based rideshare companies, specifically Uber and Lyft, and also food delivery companies like DoorDash. The business model of these companies is built around not providing benefits for their employees, the drivers, or really being liable for anything they do.
Not paying minimum wage.
Yes. The foundation of basically the entire gig economy. And AB5 changed that. So Uber and Lyft basically went through all five stages of grief except acceptance in reacting to this. First, they said it didn't apply to them. This was the funniest, the denial stage. So the law says that if you're a worker doing something that is part of a company's core business, then you have to be considered an employee. And Uber and Lyft said driving cars is not part of their core business. They are but a technology platform that serves a number of different kinds of technologies and clients. Driving cars is just one of many things that Uber and Lyft are famous for. So they were like, oh, okay, that's interesting that you passed that. It doesn't have anything to do with us. We're going to continue not paying our workers properly. But pretty quickly, they got together to put a measure on the state ballot. That's what you do when you have billions of dollars to circumvent the legal system entirely. And so this ballot initiative is driver specific. Mm-hmm. And it would consider app-based drivers to be independent contractors and not employees or agents.
This is hilarious.
Override.
I love this approach.
It's really funny. Yep, that's great. It would override AB5 just completely. Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash each put in $30 million for the campaign against this law that, again, they say does not apply to them. They're just for some, out of the goodness of their heart, they decided to put $30 million into overriding it. They also got Instacart and Postmates to throw in $10 million each to sort of complete their planeteers of wage slavery. Do you know how much they put in like $110 million total. Do you know how much the opposition has put in to this ballot measure?
Like a fiver?
$645,000. Okay. So they're tremendously outraged, but I think it benefits from the fact that like no one really likes Uber. Uber is
this
generally
is
considered
incredible. It's incredible though, because AB5 was complex, like you're saying. It did cause problems in specific industries, which are now attempting to be resolved in the legislature. This was, I in my opinion, a good faith effort by Lorena Gonzalez to stop this type of misclassification. It's funny to me that these app-based companies decided, instead of trying to band together with other industries, they would do something only for themselves, pretend that it was for the benefit of their drivers, most of whom hate them.
That's absolutely.
There's not really a natural constituency here.
The amazing thing, this is meant to be a compromise bill. So what Prop 22 does, in addition to making these employees independent contractors permanently, it also increases it does provide a minimum wage for drivers. It gives them a limit to the hours they're allowed to work, healthcare subsidies, some accident insurance, accidental death insurance. Just like basically gets part of the way. Oh, and they also say that they'll implement anti-discrimination and sexual harassment policies, basically saying, please, 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 we will be good. Please don't undermine the fundamental aspect of our company, which is that we don't want to treat our workers like employees, like up to like those basic standards. Like, we'll come part of the way there if you just agree to not ruin our business.
Cementing that their primary innovation is rolling back a century's worth of labor rights gains.
That should have been their argument. Like that's our main business is not driving cars. It's exploiting workers. So vote no on Prop 22.
Okay.
Prop 23, Scott.
23. I mean, this one's going to be quick. Because I mean, we're
dialysis.
We're back. We are back to our old stomping grounds. The kidney dialysis ballot measure. There have been recent attempts to change the way that kidney dialysis centers operate through propositions such as this that did not pass, as far as I recall. So the new one, Prop 23, is actually, in my opinion, much more sane and reasonable to bring to voters than than previous efforts, which focused on like limiting profit margins and things that we kind of just threw up our hands and said, we have no idea what is even being asked of this. So we're going to just default to vote no. In this case, Prop 23 is, first of all, to say the reason why we're even doing this at all, this does seem, again, like something that the legislature should be handling, the operation of a specific industry, but they largely have not done so. There has been a lot of research that has shown kidney dialysis centers are vastly underregulated, can mm-hmm. result in lots of long-term debt for people who need them and are not even regulated as to the quality of the service that is provided. So what Proposition 23 proposes to do is to require that dialysis sites have licensed physicians on site during treatment. If it's an outpatient facility, that has not typically been the case. And it also makes requirements about, or I guess it also allows for nurse practitioners to be on site, but it basically medicalizes the kidney dialysis center in a way that you would hope and expect that they already would be, but apparently have not been. So
nurses on site, it's like, where they are, who's there?
Yeah, no, they're calling, they're teleconferencing in. Yeah, so this is a yes from me. It seems like in a rational world, this would already be the bare minimum, so it wouldn't have any effect. But if it does have an effect, I can only see it being a positive one for patients.
Okay, let's move on to Prop 24. This is a fun one. This is something that we've talked about on the show previously, I think, but it comes from a guy named Alistair McTaggart,
yep.
who was a real estate developer in San Francisco. And basically, this story begins where Alistair McTaggart is at a dinner party and he's talking to some tech person. And he's just like, what's up?
Yeah.
And the tech guy is like, I'm working at this tech company. It rocks. Look at how much of your personal information I just have on my phone that I can just like pull up and like I can just like show you where you are and where anyone else is at any given time. And we just have access to all this like unleashed personal information. And this basically, Alistair McTaggart left that party and has just gone absolutely ham ever since, stopping these people's personal privacy from being violated on the internet. He qualified for the ballot in 2018 for this privacy measure, but then the California state legislator negotiated with him to remove it from the ballot if they passed a law, which they did, the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018, and he agreed to stand down, even though he had already spent $3 million, because he got a version of what he wanted,
right?
Which is what has brought us the best thing to happen to the internet in the last decade, which is the little toggle that we have in California now that says, do not sell my personal information. And so now you get the joy yep. of toggling that on whenever you go to a new website. It rocks. It's entirely thanks to basically this one person, Alistair McTaggart. He is not done. He is going back to the ballot and he says, he's like, this was a good start. I want to make sure that they cannot undo this. He says, quote, there's basically unlimited resources on one side of the fight. If you don't do anything, they will win eventually. Bob Hertzberg, who had tried to get McTaggart to stand down the first time if they agreed to pass this law, has given up. Such is the power of Alistair McTaggart's conviction. And he's like, whatever, just this is the right thing. Just do it. It does a lot of stuff. It protects people's information. It establishes a California Privacy Protection Agency that enforces these privacy laws. It triples penalties for violations concerning consumers under age 16. Lots of stuff. Oh, and it also authorizes civil penalties for theft of consumer login information. A lot of different things designed to protect people's privacy. It's great that we have someone fighting for this. Once again, it's unfortunate that it has to be a super rich person if you're going to accomplish anything. And we've suffered from rich individuals doing very bad things through the ballot measure system. But this person, luckily, is obsessed with something good, which is protecting people's personal information on the
internet. Props to him. And also, props sounds relatively like the character, secondary character in a Batman comic who like gets killed off by the supervillain in Act One, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Who's like kind of the initial bad guy who like meets Bruce Wayne for sure at a party. Yeah. Okay. Let's go to prop 25, and this is our last one, and then we'll run through them in 10 seconds.
Let's finish up. So prop 25, this one, again, this is pretty simple. You're voting yes, and here's why. So very recently, the state of California voted historically to change its money bail system. This was the product of, I mean, a years or decades long fight to eliminate the notion that you should be in jail while you're awaiting trial if you are too poor to pay for your freedom until you were able to be judged. While the final version of the bill that ended up passing was not sufficient, it is a start, and it is a start that moves California in the appropriate direction. Prop 25, much like the discussion that we were just having about Prop 22, is solely an interest group trying to put us back to a status quo that was poisonous and bad and wrong. In this group, in this case, the interest groups are, again, the DA's union, the prosecutors, the law enforcement community, and most notably, the bail bondsmen, whose industry is basically being targeted for elimination as it should be. What they would like is to overturn the law that was passed by the California state legislature. This is a referendum where they're saying, basically, do you approve of this or do you want it repealed? It is logical trickery, obviously, being employed. But the goal here is to make you undo what the legislature did in voting to change over a period of years the cash bail program.
That's
so
right.
What we want to see here, as people who don't think that there should be just pretrial detention based on your income or wealth, is that you vote yes in order to signal that you are supportive of changes made by the California legislature. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So this is the really tricky thing about it. Scott is absolutely right. The bail industry put this measure on the ballot so you would vote no on it. Just like a curveball. They're just like, they have the money in all of these horrible industries to just try stuff. And they seem to think that a no is more likely than a yes on something like this. So they put something on the ballot that says, hey, do you want to uphold this thing that the legislature did? Hoping that you will vote no. But the way that you should actually vote is yes. Let's run through them really fast, starting from the beginning. Prop 14, stem cell research. Tentative yes. That's the only one that I'm leaving myself a little window to hear more about it. Prop 15, taxing properties based on what they're actually worth. Undoing Prop 15 from 1979. Yes on Prop 15. Prop 16, repeals Prop 209, which is a ban on affirmative action. Yes on Prop 16. Prop 17 gives the right to vote to people who are on parole. Yes on Prop 17. Prop 18 allows 17-year-olds to vote as long as they're 18 at the time of the election. Yes on Prop 18. Prop 19 changes the rules around real estate inheritance transfers and some other stuff. Yes on Prop 19. Prop 20 makes changes to sentencing policies to make them more strict, undoes some past loosening policies over the last decade. No on Prop 20. Prop 21 expands rent control across the state. Yes on Prop 21. Prop 22 makes app-based drivers independent contractors. No on Prop 22. Prop 23 requires a physician on-site at dialysis clinics. Yes on Prop 23. Prop 24 expands your privacy on the internet, stops companies from selling your information. Yes, on Prop 24. Prop 25 replaces the cash bail system, upholds what the legislature already did. Yes, on Prop 25. Did I get that
right? You did. Nailed it.
It's so difficult to be a voter in California. Thank you for listening to this episode, this special episode of LA Podcast. Pretty sure Alyssa is going to be back next week. Look forward to that. Thank you for subscribing to our Patreon. We're going to watch a movie this week for 30 Mile Zone as part of our bonus content. We haven't decided what yet, but you can vote on it today, Monday, on our Patreon. Thanks again for listening. Bye.